welcome everyone to a very special Brainstorm Brewery. I'm your host, Marcel MTG. I'm joined by the Warren Buffett of MTG Finance, Mr. Jason Ault. Hey everybody, I'm a different guy from Marcel, which is why my voice is different. Yeah, that's a good story. I'm also joined by my sub-host, Corbin Hostler, C-Hoss, the Hustler. Introduce yourself, Hostler.
You know, of all the nicknames I thought I might be given right there, that was an acceptable one.
Yeah, whatever, nerd. I'm also joined by my other sub-host, Ryan Bushard.
I'll allow it. Sub-host. It's going to be hard to get used to.
Yeah, that's great. We're joined by a very special guest today, Mr. Douglas Johnston. I feel like Marcel would say Johnston, right? Probably.
Yeah, probably.
That's correct, yeah.
Or he'd get Douglas wrong.
Oh, yeah. Douglas the Targo Moif Johnston.
Douglas.
No, Marcel.
Douglas.
Douglas. I think it's French. No, we are joined by the very famous BrainstormBrewery.com finance writer of the Conjured Currency series, and winner of the Gamers Helping Gamers?
Yes.
Gamers Helping Gamers Scholarship, Mr. Douglas Johnston.
More important. Go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Wow.
I was gonna include that. Most importantly, we found out that he's also a member of his school's competitive League of Legends team, which I find extremely impressive.
There was like one girl out there that was gonna sleep with him after my intro, and then like, now she's not. So, way to go.
First of all, it's the B team, so it's not that impressive. And second of all, very famous is a bit of generous, considering I've been a fan of the podcast for almost 2 years now, I think.
That's longer than I've been a fan.
But yeah, thanks a bunch for having me on. It means a lot.
Oh, we don't like to hear that. We only want guests that aren't impressed to be on here.
We're very happy to have you on the podcast, despite what Jason or Marcel, whichever the one he's being at the moment, says.
The voices are different, man.
The meaner Jason is to you, the more he likes you. That's the key to remember here.
Yeah, I've learned that. In my year and 3 months of working for him, I've learned that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that might just be his cover to be a dick. We don't really know. But
working for Jason, I had never thought about that. That's a scary concept.
I know.
Yeah, wait till you realize you also are a part of that website, Ryan. Then it'll really blow your mind.
Well, I mean, I wrote an article. When's the last time you did that?
What does that mean?
I'm just... I don't know, but if we're being mean right off the bat, we're coming back.
I have multiple articles on our website, Ryan.
No, and our listeners can go check out all of those articles. You can check out Doug's weekly series called Conjured Currency, and you can check out the article Ryan wrote that I will get around to posting.
Well, I mean, it's going to take you probably a full day just to make it readable, so.
It's probably true.
You know what's
fun? This is something I'm embarrassed about. Like, no, it's been full of knowledge that I'm a terrible writer.
What after hours was that where Ryan was struggling with?
The WordPress one?
Oh, yeah, because where he didn't submit it to WordPress.
How do you use WordPress? How do you copy-paste?
He just sent me an email. He's like, I did another article, and he didn't submit it to WordPress, so the editor didn't know about it.
It was just, how do you copy-paste to WordPress? I don't understand.
You told me, to be fair, I would have done the WordPress thing, but you told me, just send it to me.
No, the part is when you tried to get on, you tried to get on WordPress.
Oh,
and
no.
Real time, we got to listen to you fail to figure it out.
I understand what happened then, and it was a mistake. Mistakes were made. I attempted to use computer technology. That's not always a positive. It's usually not a positive, but yeah, no. This time around, I could have figured out WordPress, but Jason was like, email it to me, so I did.
All right.
Like 2 weeks
mistakes
ago.
Were made. We'll leave it at that.
Yes. That can be the name of the episode.
Yeah. Anyways, we're without Marcel this week, so sorry you guys don't get your weekly dose of Marcel's segues. But on that note, let's talk about Finance 101.
Oh, so Corbin's driving the bus, I see. There was a brief power struggle where we were insulting each other, and then...
Where everyone was refusing to drive the bus, yeah.
Corbin emerge at the top of the heap. All right, let's do what Corbin said to do.
I think I drew the short straws, really, how you put that.
Can I get off the bus?
It's a short bus. You belong.
Oh,
is that because he's handicapped?
You can't make handicapped jokes. Dude.
That's messed up.
That's fucked up, Corbin.
Jesus, dude.
You know what? Wow. That wasn't what I was.
Out of that hole. I can't hear.
That's not
Wizards
what I was
of
going
the Coast
for.
Coverage employee Corbin Hostler.
That's not what I was going for, but I'll roll with it.
There's not one of those.
You'll
like,
roll with it, really, like in a wheelchair, dude.
There's not one of those elevator seats in the back, so you can't get off.
Oh, it's funny because he's a guest and he's making fun of Ryan.
I mean, that's why he's a guest. He feels right at home.
Yeah, I expect that if people aren't willing to make fun of me, they shouldn't be a guest.
All right, Finance 101. We wanted to talk about, and Doug actually brought this to our attention. It was going around the interwebs today. People were having a discussion about bulk rares. And basically, I guess, in the Finance 101 section of this, we really want to cover what a bulk rare means for you in your collection. You know, I think we all understand kind of the concept of a bulk rare. It's those cards that a dealer doesn't really want to buy through for a special price, you typically get the going rate of 10 to 12 cents per bulk rare. So I guess kind of the question is, where does that line fall for you guys? Is it every rare that's under a dollar TCG mid? Is it under 50 cents? How do you kind of determine if you're trying to move out your cards or just trying to value them? Say somebody wants to trade for your bulk rare or something like that. How do you guys kind of differentiate between what's a bulk rare and what is, you know, a dollar rare or whatever?
I think it really comes down to what I'm going to do with it. Like, if it's not worth listing on TCG Player, you might as well bulk it out. So you have something like TCG Mid's 49 cents, and a guy is selling it for 49 cents free shipping or something like that. And you're looking at it, and you're like, there's no money to be made selling on TCG Player. If it sells, the card's cheap because nobody wants it, first of all. So really, if the most cost-effective way to get rid of it is just jam it in a box and sell it for a dime, then that's kind of a bulk rare to me. If there's no way to make more than 10 cents on it, then it's a bulk rare.
So, Doug, what was your take on it? Because I know we were talking about it a little before the cast, and you had kind of had your own take on it.
I don't buy list to online stores as much as most people who do finance would, I guess, mostly just because I'm too lazy. But I generally sort my lower value rares into either bulk rares, $1 rares, or $2 rares, generally based around what the TCG mid is. Like if it's like $1.80, I'll put it in the $2 box, or if it's 95 cents, I'll put it in the dollar box, usually. But to determine whether or not it's a bulk rare, I'll usually look up the buy list price on the Trader Tools app for Quiet Speculation subscribers. And I will, if it has a buy list price of generally higher than a quarter, I'll put it in the dollar, and it has a TCG mid price of above a dollar or whatever, I'll put it in the dollar box. But if it doesn't, even if it has a TCG mid price of approximately a dollar, I'll put it in the bulk rare box. And then I basically just put that out in my display case and just sell bulk rares for a quarter out of it. And some people just find deals that they appreciate, because I think Chandra's Phoenix right now has a TCG mid of like 89 cents or something like that. But its buy list price is practically zero, so no dealer wants it ever because it rotated. So I'll put it in the bulk rare box and sell it for a quarter to someone who's building a red deck because it has a dollar price, but they can find it for a quarter.
Oh, nice. So you price the stuff aggressively to blow through it, I see. Because I kind of just put that stuff in my display case. I have a dollar box, but I'm like, if you buy three cards, it's, you know, $2.50 or something like that. It scales. The more cards you buy, the cheaper it is. So I have people just sell handfuls of rares, get handfuls of rares out of there, because like, well, you know, if it's $7 for 10 rares, I might as well get 10. So
that's not a bad idea, actually. I have the dollar box at my store, and I just sell them all for a dollar. I should probably make it like six for $5 or something.
Yeah, like it's like a dollar cheaper to buy three or something or four, and it's like
right.
$2 cheaper to buy six or something. Like it kind of do a scaling thing, and that encourages people to buy more. And it's stuff that's good in EDH. It's not like total poop. There's stuff like Boros Battle Shaper and, you know, some primordials and stuff in there. So it's stuff that'll move. That's a good way to get rid of Sylvan Primordial.
I actually recently
just took that out of my dollar box because it has a TCG mid of 90 something cents, but the buy list price is basically nothing because no BIOS wants it due to the fact that it's banned. So I just took it out of my dollar box and threw it in the bulkware box, and eventually someone's going to go through it, and their playgroup's not going to care that it's banned in EDH because they had never heard of an EDH ban list, and they're going to jam it in their deck.
Yeah, I mean, so all right, so let's bring this back around to, for players who have collections, you know, obviously with a bunch of rares like this, are they better off keeping it in a binder and trying to trade it out for a dollar? Or are they best off just saying, you know what, I should just turn these into a dealer, you know, understand that it has an 80-cent TCG player mid, but just take the dime on it and just let them add up and get something I really want? What do you think is the best way for players to kind of manage their own bulk?
I think get your binder cleaned out every once in a while. Just go to a dealer and just let them take that stuff. It's going to sit there. So you got to really think about what can you do with it. And if you can take it to a dealer, have them pay a dime or maybe like 12, 13 cents on it, and on top of that get a trade-in bonus, that's how you can really maximize that stuff. Because there is a lot of rares that are just kind of go from like theoretical money but no dealers buying them to absolute bulk at rotation. And your two choices are, I would hold on to the stuff that I think has a hope of going back up later. But for the stuff that's just like the total dregs, I think you might want to look at trying to couple a trade-in bonus with a dealer just kind of paying a little bit more. If they're paying even 11 cents, sometimes it's worth it just to take it to a dealer and just have them clean that page of your binder out, because you're just going to accumulate that stuff. And if you don't have an out like my display case, like, why not?
And the other thing is that kind of the way I like to term it is a focus binder makes trades. So you could have a bunch of nice cards in your binder and stuff that people want, but if they have to look through 15 pages of bulk rares to find it, you just get tired after about that like 20th page you flip through. Like at some point you just don't need all that extra stuff, and you're better off having a smaller binder with cards that people actually want in it.
Yeah, people will just make the assumption that like, is every page going to be like this?
Yeah. Yeah, and you just get bored. Like, just give up on it. It's just, the fatigue sets in. It's a real thing. You don't want to spend 15 minutes looking through somebody's binder to try to find something.
Yeah, so I mean, periodically, just let that stuff get cleaned out. Like, for some people, it's distasteful to take, you know, a mere dime on a rare that's theoretically worth a dollar. You know, some people have a tough time getting over that, but once you do, it really just keeps your binder orderly. And if there's anything you think you might play in another format, fine, pull it out and keep it. But for the most part, just like, it doesn't make sense to sit on that. And it doesn't make sense to like, sell it all the time either, because it's never gonna be worth less than bulk, you know? But
yeah.
But still, if you can, I would recommend trying to get a trade-in bonus in there, because you can get more than a dime for it.
Yeah, and they add up, honestly. All those bulk rares after a year of Magic, you know, if you're doing it a rotation, whatever, like, they add up, and you can turn it into cards you actually need. Alright, so let's move on. Let's kind of put the spotlight on the guests this week. Doug, why don't you go ahead and tell us, let's walk through, I mean, how did you get your start in Magic, and then we'll talk about the scholarship and everything like that. So how long have you, been involved in the game?
I was hoping to get interviewed by Marcel's smoothie, silky voice, but I guess
no. I apologize.
Well, he found out who our guest was this week, and he's like, "Yeah, I'm gonna take it off."
Oh,
jeez,
wrecked.
Wow. All right.
That was awkward, isn't it?
I guess, like, I don't know.
Jeez.
Anyways,
Jason.
Ignore everything Jason says
ever. Not just
even
that,
my advice. Don't sell your bulk rares, guys.
No, tell it. When did you first start playing Magic? What was your first set and your introduction into the game?
I first started playing a little after Return to Ravnica, a little after the original Ravnica. It was around Shadowmoor, Eventide block, but I wasn't buying all the Shadowmoor packs or whatever. I just started with a Selesnya starter deck that someone gave to me that was slightly tuned, because I started with Yu-Gi-Oh! And I taught my friend how to play Yu-Gi-Oh! In exchange for him teaching me how to play Magic. We both just sort of gave up on our original games. So he sort of converted me into Magic and gave up on Magic while I did the same to him for Yu-Gi-Oh!
Interesting.
And he gave me a Selesnya starter deck to get get going in the game, which in hindsight had a lot of expensive cards that I just tore to shreds without using sleeves. I had a Reese in that deck. I had a privilege position, all of which are probably washing machine condition by now. But I started playing casually just like everyone else, and I was bad and I was terrible for several years until I moved into high school, at which point I relocated to a different town, and I didn't have any friends in that town during that summer, so I just sort of put myself through an internet magic boot camp, so to speak, over the summer, and just read every magic strategy article, every draft advice article, and just sort of learned about the competitive aspect of the game, because my new town actually had a local game store where I could go buy booster packs and go to Friday Night Magics and whatnot. And I just sort of grew into the competitive aspect of the game from a Friday Night Magic perspective anyway.
Great. Yeah, I mean, so how did you, I guess, and this is probably good, relevant for a lot of our listeners, how did you move into, I guess, caring about the finance side of things? You know, you go from playing casually to kind of making the jump towards competitive. When did the financial side of the game really stand out to you?
It was really just me trying to be able to afford a standard deck at that point. It was around Rise of the Eldrazi, and Scars of Mirrodin was the first set that I ever actually owned a booster box from. It was a birthday present. Like, my first booster box was a birthday present. And I wanted to build competitive elves at that point, which had Vengevine, like $40 Vengevines, $20 Eldrazi Monuments, and all that crazy stuff that I couldn't afford at the time. So that was a dead dream to me. And then when Mirrodin Besiege came out, I got a booster box with Tezzeret in it, and I wanted to build a Tezzeret artifact deck for Standard because that was an actual competitive thing. And so I just sort of had to grind a tiny binder full of $1 and $2 in bulk rares into a competitive Standard deck, and I just sort of tried to watch the price trends of how cards moved and just stay up and up and try to trade up where I could. And eventually that turned into what it is today, which is basically a mini version of what Jason does.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I guess one of the, you know, I think the really cool things is that you are one of the recipients of the Gamers Helping Gamers Scholarship, which if, you know, people don't know, it's something that, you know, a bunch of kind of old school Magic players are involved in, you know, Finkel, Chris Pecula are all involved in this, and it's really a cool idea. Why don't you tell us about how you found out about it, how you applied for it, just kind of like what that process was like and how it was different than, you know, the 100 other scholarships that everyone applies for when they're coming out of high school.
All right. In my senior year of high school, the notice came up. I don't even remember how I found out about it. It might have been through a Facebook link or a Twitter link or something of that sort. But the link came out of basically, this is going to happen. We are trying to make a scholarship for Magic players, but we don't have the money yet. And so I just sort of bookmarked the tab and just said, oh, that's neat. I guess I'll check up on that in a few months. And then after John Finkel top-aided Pro Tour Dark Ascension and Pro Tour Abyssin Restored, he donated half of his winnings from each tournament to that scholarship fund and then basically said, there, we have enough money now. So that was really cool. And right after they opened up applications around right after Pro Tour Abyssin was. I don't remember what month that was. And then I just sort of refound out about it. And they required my high school transcript, my college intentions and my, like, what I wanted to do in my life, basically, essay. And they wanted an essay of what my past history of Magic was. Oh, they wanted my DCI records. That was the other thing. And they wanted, basically a few essays about Magic, such as what was my favorite card and why, or what was my least favorite card or mechanic and why. And basically just wanted to pick my brain about the thought process of how I played and like what I've learned from Magic and all that. And so my high school guidance counselor actually thought the scholarship was basically bullshit too, which I thought was kind of funny when I asked for my transcript. I asked for my official high school transcript and he said, what was it for? And I told him, well, I'm applying for a scholarship for a trading card game. And he said, okay, well, basically good luck with that. I don't think anything's going to come of it. Don't get your hopes up. And after graduation, I just get an email from Timothy McKenna, and it basically just says, congratulations, you're the first or inaugural winner of our Gamers Helping Gamers Scholarship. You're going to receive $5,000 a year for 4 years as long as you're in college. So that was pretty much my achievement in life.
I mean, it's pretty impressive. And you take it back to the guidance counselor, wave it in his face.
I didn't get to because that was after classes that ended in the...
That's too bad. Well,
you could have done it anyway.
But I mean, he is a high school guidance counselor now, so...
I would have made a special trip just to do that, I think.
I probably still should. Just like 3 years later, just still do that.
Actually, just send him a link to this podcast.
Yeah, that's fair. Exactly right. Yeah.
I actually have an article. My name's actually in the New York Times, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, I saw that article about the scholarship in the Times. It's pretty awesome.
Corbin calls it the Times because he's a serious journalist.
It's got a great title. The title of the article is Tuition Aid from a Zombie Elf. It doesn't get a lot better than that.
I thought he was talking about the Times had a great name. I'm like, well, yeah, it's been around for a while. I thought this was like Corbin stating obvious things as usual. All right.
I thought we
were going to go out on a limb, guys, and say that the New York Times is a pretty good newspaper.
Yeah. Anyway, so I guess so what is your involvement, you know, now that you've you got the scholarship, you know, have you got to meet any of the people who kind of are any of the big names that are a part of it?
I did get to meet Finkel at Pro Tour Philadelphia. Which was sealed Grand Prix, or did I say Pro Tour Philadelphia? Grand Prix Philadelphia. That's probably what I went to. I don't think I've ever been to a Pro Tour. But I met him at Grand Prix Philadelphia, and I ended up playing Five Colors sealed with Born of the Gods sealed. And I showed him my deck, and my pool was actually just god-awful, so I don't think there was anything really better I could have done. And he confirmed that, which kind of made me feel better. But I went, I actually opened a Chromanticore, and then I had to pass it. I opened a Chromanticore in my sealed pool, and then I passed it saying good luck to whichever fucker had to deal with that. And then I get, a five-color pool with just all the mana fixing in the world and a few decent color bombs.
Oh, and no Chromanticore.
Jason,
so the pool that I actually got passed, I was thinking this could really use a Chromanticore, which upset me, but, I met Finkel at Philadelphia, and he was very nice, and he was very, cordial and shook my hand and basically, like, checked up on how I was doing, and that was nice, but I've never met Tim McKenna or Pakula or Dark Confidant, so.
Yeah, that's right. Bob Marr is a part of it as well. So I think the moral of this story is that John Finkel, whether he blocks or not, he is an awesome guy who, you know, donated his winnings
to help
kids go to school.
He had to be shitty, huh? Finkel just say something nice.
Every Pro Tour, I think it was at Worlds, he had a list of around 14 or 15 people who he basically said, if any of these people win, I will donate, I think it was $4,000 to the Gamers Helping Gamers Scholarship right now.
That's right, I saw that. That's awesome.
So he's been a huge driving force behind the funds that the scholarship gets, and I don't think it would exist without him.
Yeah, it is awesome to see people who are part of the community who come into money one way or the other and actually like giving back to said community. Definitely can't argue with that.
The reason why I asked to be on the podcast was just to promote the scholarship as much as I could and try to get a record number of applicants this year. I can't exactly donate back 10 grand right now, but I can do my best now that I have an outlet and platform to stand on to basically shout out to every college Magic playing kid in the world and saying, hey, this scholarship exists, apply for it right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's really great because, and I imagine it's an interesting position for Finkel because here's somebody who's still playing the game, but at the same time, he remembers when, you know, he was a kid trying to make the rounds when the game was just getting started, and now he's actually in a position to give back. Honestly, it's one of the, you know, we all went through the whole process of going from high school to college and fighting through all those scholarships. Everyone who has experience with that knows that whole process can take its toll on you. So I think it's just super awesome to see something like this so tailored to our community. Great. So tell me more, where can people find out about, you know, you're talking about people applying. What do they need to do to apply? How can they find out about it?
I actually wrote an article that goes more into detail about the scholarship application. It's Conjured Currency number 43, I think, but it's on brainstormbrewery.com, and it basically goes into detail about the application process and what you need to submit to the board or board of executives or whatever you want to call it, e-board, something along the lines. But you need to submit your high school transcript. You need to submit I believe your DCI records. I think you still need to give them those just to prove that you actually play Magic to an extent. And there's 3 to 4 essay questions you have to answer. One is, what is your history of Magic and, like, how did you learn to play Magic? What got you into the game? Another is, what have you learned by playing Magic, and what is your future in the game, and what do you intend to do with your life? And small aside, I actually, in my essay applying for the scholarship, I wrote, this was 3 years ago, back about how the financial aspect of the game had helped me out, and how I listened to Kelly Reed, and how I, like, read Craig Wesco's financial articles on TCG Player, and Chaz Andres, and those guys, and how I tried to keep ahead of financial trades and stuff, and basically how Magic had helped me in pretty much every aspect of my life. And the third article is, what is your favorite card or mechanic and why, and what is your least favorite card or mechanic and why? And the reason the New York Times article was Tuition Aid from a Zombie Elf is because my favorite card that I wrote about is Glissa the Traitor. And anyone from Watertown, New York, or Oswego, New York, knows that I sort of have a monopoly on almost every single copy of Glissa the Traitor in the New York area. I have a couple hundred copies of the card, and I'm still searching for more, and I have an EDH deck built around her, and I actually have a custom-made playmat of the art of the card that a friend got me for a graduation present, too. But
that's pretty hardcore.
Yeah.
And what was your favorite mechanic?
I actually wrote about my least favorite mechanic, which was Storm, which in hindsight, looking back a few years...
So you're going to send that to John Finkel?
Yeah, send it to Finkel.
I just thought about that in the past year. Like, I wrote about how much I hate Storm, and Finkel still picked me. But
that's ballsy.
For those of you who don't know, Finkel has played quite a bit of Storm in the past few years.
Because back then I was more of a casual FNMer player, and since that article and since the scholarship, I've sort of fallen back on more combo decks when I do play competitive events. So, in hindsight, I don't really care that Storm is unfair. I'm just using it to win.
Yeah.
I've sort of lost the like innocence of I hate Storm, and now I just want to go make 10,000 Kiki Jikis and kill you.
Excellent.
All right, so let's move on to some emails then, and then we'll get to a pick of the week here. We have a giant backlog, I know. That's what happens when I get sick and go out of the country. They read no emails. But here we go. We're just going to dive into them here.
We may or may not have read emails.
Yeah, we're the bad guys here?
I literally asked you guys if you'd read them. You're like, I don't remember. I hope we don't do any repeats.
You said you hope we don't do any repeats. We don't care.
Yeah, we just, you just silent.
That's even better. You just don't care if we
ever repeat. Yeah, if some nerd gets his email read once, he's going to be like, oh, they read my email on the cast. If he gets his email read twice, he'd be like, I'm the only person ever to get my email read twice.
And someone else is like, oh, my email didn't get read because of this asshole. Anyways... first one here is from William Munn. He says, hey guys, I am looking at trading some decent legacy staples for a From the Vault Exiled Foil Berserk in near mint condition. I've looked at MTG stocks and noticed that it's risen in value significantly. What do you guys think about its current value? It isn't on the reserve list on Modern anymore. Thanks for the input. By the way, thanks for always having an interesting and insightful cast, y'all. Slick Willy, Edgewater, Florida. So, yeah, he's talking about...
I feel
about
like we'd remember reading an email
anything written by a guy named Slick Willy.
He's asking about trading into a Berserk from the Vault Exiled.
Yeah, but FTV was, like, the only way to reprint that, right? That seems relatively safe from another reprint.
Yeah, I mean, 6 months ago...
Maybe
they'll
do an FTV Anthologies.
Oh, God.
I think... Oh, man. I think that his question here revolves mostly around the fact that 4 months ago, this card was basically $45 to $50, and it recently hit a high of $90 last week. So what do we really think's driving the price on this? It had been steady for a year and a half.
Somebody started paying attention to it. Like, it doesn't take much to, with the few copies that are out there listed, it doesn't take much to just start buying up the cheap copies. And that's what somebody did. Somebody just started being like, you know what? This has been too cheap for too long. There's no play or anything driving it. Cause people are gonna do what they always do, which was their whole justification after the fact song and dance they like to do. They're like, oh, it's going up, therefore there's merit to it. And then they'll look at like, well, I guess it gets played in Legacy Infect, so that's probably what's doing it. You know what? Someone had just started paying attention, I think. Someone's like, I think the price should be higher than it is. And they bought a few copies, and that was really all it took.
I mean, there's exactly 8 on TCG Player right now.
Exactly.
And exactly 3 near mint copies.
And if it was $40, you could spend $300 and all of a sudden turn around and list every copy for 90. And then you made $400 just by paying attention to a card that is not getting reprinted anytime soon, and the price is pretty steady on.
Yeah, so to answer your question, I think that the current price of a, you know, kind of fluctuating between 80 and 90 is likely pretty solid. I mean, it's very hard to reprint. It's a from the vault. It's not likely to see this again. I feel pretty comfortable saying that the price is going to remain relatively stable.
And that's exactly why somebody moved in on it, for all those reasons.
Yeah. And also, every year, one more copy of that card becomes a curled into what looks like a tube.
That's right. That's from the vault printings.
Please don't do any anthologies. The whole anthologies box will look like an arc.
Well, can they do that? Because they were marketed as limited
edition? No, I don't think so,
like,
because it's marketed
edition?
As limited. Yeah, and the dual decks never were. Yeah. No, I don't think we'll see that. If we, like, I think it would be cool if they did, like, an FTV anthologies and did them all as non-foils. I would be okay with that. And like that, a lot of that, like that product would sell super quick. And on top of that, like everyone like really couldn't complain about it because, I mean, it's not the same
thing. Yeah, they'll complain about anything. They could do FTV $100 bill and people would complain if it was folded lengthwise.
That's fair. Well, the other problem with it is too, they've, you gotta remember they messed up with the reserve list and some of those FTVs with the Mox Diamond. So they can't, they won't do that again. So like that's completely safe.
Of all the things to complain about, it's the undermining your confidence in the reserve list. It's a reprint of Mox Diamond. That's fun. What are you gonna do?
Well, no, but I'm saying like they can't, like because they messed up and they went back and already said they wouldn't like do that again.
Right.
They can't do it again.
Yeah.
So actually, like all those FTVs seem super safe.
Yeah, I agree. All right, let's move on to our next one here from Lee Davis. He says, I've been offered a sizable collection of cards that are not exactly value heavy. He's been offered them on a brokerage basis. I'm kind of summarizing the first couple paragraphs here. But he's got two questions. First, what is a fair percentage to take on the deal when you're selling for someone else? And second, what is the best way to deal with cards from some of the lowest value sets in MTG history? These cards are from the 1994-96 era. I know there will be some revised duels and complete sets of both Ice Age and the Dark, but most of the value is likely to be in the 75 cents to a dollar range, like Hymn to Torok. At such low individual card prices, are TCG or eBay player fees too large and should send me to buy lists, or are they small enough to make outing play sets myself worthwhile? In a similar vein, is there any value to be gained in keeping the sets together? Or are they more liquid than their worst pieces? So I think let's kind of try to distill this down here. The first question is Lee has been offered a collection to sell on a brokerage basis, meaning he would get a percentage of what he ends up selling those cards for because he's doing the work for someone else. So let's tackle that first. Is that something you guys have experience with? And,
yes.
You know, what advice do you – well, yeah, I know. What advice do you have for someone who's kind of getting into this?
You have to be careful. The first couple of times I did it, I was like, oh, you know, 10%, 20%, that'd be fine. Especially when you're doing collections of all this small stuff like this, the percentage you have to get on some of this stuff is 40 to 50% if you're really just selling a bunch of that small stuff, because the amount of time and effort and then the shipping costs and everything else on top really adds up. So just be very careful when you're telling someone an initial percentage that you're not doing a disservice to yourself and end up doing all this work for free.
Yeah. I mean, so the second part of his question is, what's the best way to handle those cards like Hymn to Torok that are not expensive, but they're also not, you know, invaluable, especially considering you're looking at a percentage of it and not even the full profits. Do you guys think he should try to maximize the money on these from an auction site, or is he better off just buy listing?
Here's the deal. I'm glad Doug mentioned Trader Tools, because we don't like to bring up Trader Tools. Corbin and I don't, because we write for QS, and it sounds like, oh, we love our site, but honestly, that's what I use to buy list. So if it's for the stuff that's not in a complete set, I would honestly just buy list that stuff. Because even though it's like, oh, I'm only making 10% of this or whatever, this stuff really adds up. Especially like your Hymns of Torok, the spread is going to be relatively low and stuff like that, and it's actually pretty cost effective to just ship it, especially because it would just sit on an auction site. I mean, who's going to buy him the Torok, you know, like one or two of on eBay?
Yeah. Even if I was getting 100% of the profit, I would buy lists and stuff like that. Like, you put in way more work trying to list that stuff out than you do just finding a, you know, a couple good buy lists and shipping it all off and just being happy with the money you make. Especially on something like this where you actually don't have an upfront cost. It's all profit to you, so you want to maximize your money to time ratio here, and I'm pretty sure buy listing does that.
You said there's dual lands in there though, right? You'd probably want to sell those separately.
Yeah, I mean, but for like the poop, the stuff that's not obviously worth eBaying.
Yeah. Like the Hymns and the Brainstorms, you just buy us, but like if there's Tundras in there, just sell them.
Yeah, absolutely. Try to find an individual buyer for that stuff, because that's actually something that's, you know, that's a lot more liquid than, you know, some Hymns that.
Now, if you have a complete set, especially of like a shit set like the Dark or something like that, that's probably something you want to try to eBay. Because you at least run it up the flagpole and see if anybody salutes, and you can always take it down and, you know, sell it separately later, but you're not going to move most of the cards from the Dark. Like, there's going to be two or three cards that are worth a lot, you know, and those will sell right away. And then you're going to have the stuff that's, like, worth buy listing, but then you have, like, the total dregs, and, like, you'll get nothing for those. So you're better off just, if you have a complete set, you're better off at least attempting at first to move it as a set, and just know that you have the ability to ship it. You can fall back on that.
Well, what experience do you have with, you know, selling full sets? Is that something that are people interested in that enough that he's actually going to be able to move this?
I mean, that's an eBay thing. Ryan and I have always moved full sets in person. That was something we did at Gen Con. We had a full set of Arabian Nights, and we got above Amazon moving it in person. So that was pretty good. So that's something that'll sell better than a bunch of crap rares, you know.
Yeah,
trying to
list
a Sorrow's Path on eBay.
It very much depends on the full set that you're trying to sell as well. Like, the full set of that is going to sell a lot better than, say, a full set of Homelands in person. Like, nobody in person is going to really be super interested in your Homeland set. So you're just going to have to gauge on exactly what kind of full set you're selling. And also, what is it? There was another site out there. It's a TCG, like, it essentially gave you a full list of, like, what the cards would be worth if you were to put them all up on TCG, and that's a good gauge. You can kind of see, like, what the TCG mid/low would be of a full set versus what it's going for on eBay, and base it that way as well. Because sometimes it's worth piecing some of those sets out. They don't actually sell just because, you know, there's a couple of cards in there worth a ton of money, and if everything else is worth poop, sometimes putting the good cards with the poop will make the poop worth something, and sometimes it actually just downgrades the amount the good cards are worth because nobody wants the poop. So, it's a case-by-case basis. There's no, like, set, you know, sell this on eBay, sell this here.
Right. Okay, so let's hit another one here. This one is from, Michael Bogardis, if I didn't butcher your name, but, he says, with the popularity of Duretti from the new Commander sets, what do you think about picking up reserve list staples like Gauntlet of Might and Tano's Coffin? Unlimited Gauntlets has seen some growth over the past few years, while Coffin has remained relatively unchanged. With a surge in mono-red EDH popularity, are these due for a significant jump? Reserve list is reserve list, but neither should be a bad pick, and a profit could be made in the near future, even with buying these at retail. Or do you think these are just out of the price range, and most EDH players who would want them already have them? Cheers, Michael Bogardis. So what do you guys think about, I guess we're kind of talking about, how much do you think Duretti is going to lead people to invest in expensive cards like this?
I just had to look up what Tanos' Coffin does, so I don't
think... That's what I was about to do, too.
Like, I don't think anyone that doesn't know what it does already doesn't want it in EDH.
Yeah, like, it's... Duretti's not going to be the reason it goes up. It's going to go up slowly. The reserve list matters for the purposes of, you know, as an appreciating investment, they're never getting more of these. It's going to go up slowly over time just because that's what it's going to do. Duretti's not going to make a jump. So I wouldn't pay retail hoping to cash out in the next 6 months just because of Duretti.
I can't even. There's too many words on Tondo's Coffin, man. You're old.
Oh,
tell
my
us.
Gosh. Oh,
there's
God.
A thousand lines right. of text on this card.
Tondo's Coffin, basically, it's a way to put a creature into play.
It's let me remember.
Select a creature in play. That creature is considered out of play as long as Coffin remains tapped. Hence, the creature cannot be the target of spells and cannot receive damage, use special powers, attack or defend.
It's kind of like phasing, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it protects the creature.
It's a really weird O-ring, but yes. It's like with phasing because it leaves all the stuff on it.
And it comes back with its enchantments on it, right?
It has the word hints in the rules.
I'm aware of that, but it's a good one.
To answer your question, Duretti's not going to affect this card, and it's certainly not gonna, I don't think you're, you know, multiple hundreds of dollars gauntlets of mine, it's a really good, I don't think the people buying the, pre-con commander decks are the people who are gonna spend $200 on one card for it, so.
It's fine, but it's not super necessary in that deck.
I still think Kuldotha Forgemaster is a good buy at like a dollar. Like I can't, I'm not owning 300 copies of this card trying to hype it up. I just still can't believe that card's a dollar.
You're really keen on repeating one of my picks of the week.
Whoa.
From a past week.
Shots fired. Jason, you're mean tonight.
I talked about that article like 3 weeks ago too. So
oh, boom. Wrecked.
Oh, man.
Wrecked. I don't read your articles, Doug. I pay somebody to read them for me.
Oh, jeez.
Pay me to write them.
Right? Alright, for the record, Kuldotha Forgemaster has in fact doubled over the past 3 months and is still on the climb up. So, I do agree, at a dollar, it's $1.50 TCG mid, there are plenty available for a dollar. Still think it's a pretty good pickup.
It's too goddamn cheap. Have you read Forgemaster?
I'm thinking about putting it in Tristani just because it looks
like fresh. It's a fucking tinker.
I enjoy it in my, my Shroom deck.
How many artifacts do you need to play? How many cards do you need to play to make it good?
I mean, you play Shroom and people die to Blightsteel. Yeah, that's what you do with it.
Yeah, I understand, but like, say I want to play it in Tristani with like 10 mana.
No, you don't want to play it in Tristani.
Oh, right.
But I do, because if I can copy it with Seance, I can do whatever I want.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
You can't copy a Blightsteel with Seance. It shuffles in.
No, not the Forge Master.
No.
Now you sound like Time Elemental talking about how many cards that interact
that's
with
his name.
Power conduit.
Yeah, but
that's his
mimic,
name. He's not a real
vet.
Person who was on the cast. He
I just not want vet. His real name out there.
I have Mimic Vet in the deck too. I have two ways to make tokens that I can populate.
Oh, you don't want to do that.
Yeah, Ryan, come on. Read some EDH articles before you open your mouth, man.
Ryan,
no,
you're bad.
I know. That's like, I don't want to be good at EDH. If we want to talk about good EDH, I'll go rebuild my first EDH deck. Like, I'll put Imperial Seal back in black-blue combo and win on turn two.
We don't want you to talk about EDH. That's the point.
I'm glad that you're
bad at EDH and doing something in EDH. If you put that card in your deck, you won't do anything.
Yeah.
What, Imperial Seal?
No, Forgemaster.
Oh, well, I mean,
I have one other artifact and do nothing.
Stop it. You're just trying to be bad on purpose. You're like, I'm a little too interested in EDH and it scares me, so I'm going to say something dumb. People don't think that I care about EDH.
I mean, I don't. I haven't.
Ryan will be into it just like the rest of us sooner enough.
No. This is like pretty much strictly to play against people who come over and are like, hey, do you have any magic decks built?
Yeah, that's how it begins, Ryan.
I'd rather play standard. Now I have Blue White Heroic pretty much put together, so I don't care about EDH as much.
Okay.
I mean, Blue White Heroic is superior to playing EDH.
Okay.
One of us. One of us.
Pass. Pass.
I watched that.
Okay.
Yeah, he's referencing Freaks, which is what I was referencing.
Anyways,
alright. Thanks, Corbin. Super relevant.
I'm here for you. Alright, let's move into picks of the week that don't involve Ryan playing EDH.
It's time for the pick of the week.
So, we can't do both the Forge Master as much as Doug would like to.
Let's let Doug go first, that way we don't steal his.
He's gonna take mine though.
Does that seem fair? Jason, you deserve to have your stolen 3 times tonight. You've been
That's
so mean.
That's a pretty obvious one. I think it's a pretty obvious one.
Okay.
I was gonna go with Sidisi.
You motherfucker, you did take my pick.
I knew it.
Oh.
Go on.
Like I wasn't going to. So do you see the something tyrant? It's either the brood tyrant or the blood tyrant.
Brood tyrant.
It's brood. Okay.
The CDC, the Brood Tyrant, is a card that everyone shat on when it came out.
Yeah, even me.
We did.
4-mana 3-3 that mills cards and puts zombies into play, but people played it a lot at the SCG Championship, and apparently CDC Dredge is a thing, and it's only $4.
CDC Whip is just whipping people in their face.
Yeah, I mean, this really kind of came to resurgence at the Players' Champion, or at the World Championships.
Holy goodness, my card actually spiked this week. Crap.
What was it, Ryan?
Was it a choke?
No, the whip.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, like, I called that a while ago, and now it's like up five, it's over five.
Okay. Welcome to our rotation pickup call.
I understand, but like, I talked about it when Sidisi Whip first became a thing again, and I was like, all it needs is one more deck, and then this like, Abzan Whip thing became a thing, and then sure enough,
yes.
$1 million.
I mean, the card's been climbing. I guess if we are going to just toot our horns for a second, I am proud of the fact that we as a cast called Whip at rotation because it was played a lot in block, at which point it was $1.50, and since then it's tripled up. But Doug, go on, talk more about Sidisi.
I don't know how much there's else to say. It's a $4 card when it can probably be like 10 in a few months.
Maybe we can talk about what I was going to say about it. Stole my pick of the week.
Nobody feels bad for you.
No, it was a super obvious pick. It's fine. I thought it was really funny that you actually.
It's because I knew I was gonna steal it.
All right, I'm gonna go next so I don't get scooped twice because that would really piss me off.
All right, go ahead, Jason.
Kiora.
Okay.
Yeah, Kiora really? Started to see some sideboard play. It's really good. It does stuff. It makes a big 9/9. 9/9s are hard to deal with. Kiora is going up on Moto. What, it's not going up as much in paper, which makes me think it's doable.
It's going to be in a dual deck in about a month.
Yeah, I understand. We're talking short terms, man.
It's 10 right now.
It's at an all-time low right now because of that dual deck printing coming.
Yeah,
out.
I mean, I agree. She's really good. I just, like, I don't know how risky I want to get
that
in.
That Jace just got destroyed by that dual deck printing. I don't know if QR can be any different.
I mean, I don't want to be hanging. I think it's so low right now, but everybody wants them, and no one's picking them up. I think if you just buy in and trade these out.
You buy in at, like, where do you see it? Do you buy in at 10 and trade out at, like, 15?
I don't think you need to buy in at 10 because of the dual deck printing is making everybody not really... I mean, it's a ballsy play, but I had to think on the fly here. I just think I think that nobody wants to pay cash for these right now, so I think you can get these pretty cheap. You might even be able to buy these at buy list just because people are like, that dual deck printing's coming. Because everyone saw what it did to Jace. Like, everything you guys said about it being a bad choice is why I think it's a good choice, at least in the short term.
Interesting. Okay. Okay.
It's ballsy, man. You gotta be ballsy occasionally.
I mean, you're right that the Jace didn't go lower than 6 before rotation. So, I mean,
but
if Cure
is not Jace, it's not as ubiquitous. It's just a card that's it's just like people want it right now for, it's a flavor of the month. Jace was sort of like a format defining card. So.
Yeah, and Jace was open more being in RTR than Kiora was, being in Born of the God. So you got that as well. I would not do this. However, this is Jason's call. Yeah.
It's super short term.
All right. I will jump in next. I'm going to go, looking ahead at Modern here. Valakut, the Molten Pinnacle. I know it's kind of a card that we've all traditionally ignored, just because it had the pre-release printing, from Zendikar, and that, you know, it kept it cheap for a long time. It was a dollar card for a long time.
Yeah, so did Emrakul, though, you know?
And in that said, like, it's been fairly steady at $2, the regular copies, and a little higher for the pre-release ones, but Scapeshift is an extremely real deck, and, you know, we're at a point where Modern is in a time of change, obviously, with all the speculation about the bannings. If you see Treasure Cruise get banned, but Dig Through Time remain legal, Scapeshift is the deck that was already playing Dig instead of Cruise, and I think that deck just gets way better in a post-Cruise format, if that comes to pass. Even if that does not come to pass, Scapeshift is obviously a part of the metagame, and your long-term upside on Valakut is pretty solid. But if you do get some of the bannings of people predicting and Dig remains legal, then Scapeshift could just kind of be the next force because it's so consistent. And you could easily see your Valakuts hit $5. There's actually not as many copies as you would expect for a card with a pre-release promo that was everywhere. You know, people do occasionally throw these into their EDH decks. So I have to think that there's some nice upside potential on Valakut over the next 12 months as more people enter Modern thanks to Modern Masters 2.
I'll agree with that.
Is there anything else in the deck that's expensive?
Scapeshift itself, $19.
Cryptic Command. Commands.
Yeah.
Snapcaster. Do the decks still play Snapcaster? I haven't even looked at it in a while.
They probably play a couple. I mean, it's certainly not a cheap deck. That said, the people who are buying them are going to buy their Valakut.
It's some of the most fetches, and it plays like 6 fetches, doesn't it? It plays a lot of fetches.
It does play a lot of fetches.
I mean, that said, if it becomes the best deck in the format, which it could easily do if you see a Treasure Cruise ban, it could win the next Pro Tour.
But like, what's
up.
The upside on like the cheapest card in the deck?
I mean, I think you go from 2 to 5 pretty easily.
Yeah, that's fair.
It's a lot easier to trade for a $2 Valakut than it is for a $35 Snapcaster Mage or a $20 Scapeshift.
And the deck does have it as an X of also. It's not like a one of. Despite, it should really be legendary.
It should be legendary. Yeah, so I mean that, and you've got some, like, it's just one of those that long term is one of those that's cheap enough, it can skate under the reprint radar while having some upside. It also has some cross format play because it is a card you see in Commander from time to time. So, like I said, it's a low risk, card with the possibility of a double up or more. So that's basically where I like to be with my picks, is the low entry point.
I definitely think both that and Scapeshift have a low reprint possibility in Modern Masters 2015.
Yeah, they're not going to jam just a random unsupported card in there.
I don't think you can build Scapeshift in Limited, so I think they'd have to just leave it alone.
I would be worried. I would be most worried about seeing Scapeshift in a Commander supplementary product. If Valakut was going to be in one, it probably would have been in the mono red deck we just had. So I think like Scapeshift though, that's a card that could be in a Commander product.
I don't know about Commander so much as a Plane Chaser and Arch Enemy.
Yeah, I mean, like some sort of supplementary product, I think Scapeshift is a possibility.
One interesting note about Scapeshift though is, its TCG mid is $19 and Card Kingdom is paying $16 for Scapeshift.
That's real low spread.
Yeah, I mean, it could just easily become the best deck in the format here in a month, so.
So I think the market confidence in Scapeshift is pretty there.
Maybe makes I should sense. Change my pick of the week to Scapeshift.
Alright, Ryan, what do you got for us?
Alright, so my pick of the week, jumping back to Standard, is a card that has kind of been on a slight downslide lately, Hero's Downfall. It is down to about 6 to 7 on the low on TCG. The card is not seeing any less play. If anything, it's actually seeing more play. And the thing I'm noticing about Standard right now and going forward, the only card we have spoiled and the card that people, well, I guess not the only card spoiled now, but the card that people are really excited about is the Black Wrath. And so really, if there's one thing that I think we're going to see after rotation, we're already seeing Whip decks having a strong basis and a strong foundation into what they can do. And I don't see that, you know, changing after the new set comes out. If anything, I think we're going to see any more support for a control build is going to finally like allow us some sort of counter control as well, just making that deck even better. So going forward, I would not be surprised to see Hero's Downfall hit that $10, $15 mark again, you know, somewhere between there. And I think this is just kind of playing the market. I don't think you necessarily need to go buy in for cash. The money's probably not, or the spread's not quite enough there to make that worth it, but this is a good time to be trading for them going into the next season.
I would agree with the training into them. I mean, the mid's 850 on it, so you really need the card to go to 15 in cash to make much money there. So I like think trading into them is a pretty good call, though.
Yeah, and I mean, this happens kind of every season when you come towards the end. It's just one of those cards that everyone kind of takes for granted because it's in every deck list. Everyone's so used to seeing it in every deck list, they don't really think about it anymore. And so suddenly they don't notice when it goes to 8 to 12, you know. And that doesn't even phase them afterwards. They'll just think, oh, it's probably been 12 all along, when in reality there was this point when it was $8.
All right.
Yep, that's what
all
I got.
Right. So I think that wraps us up for the week. That is all the picks. That is all the podcasting. We have great audio this week. Thanks for that, everybody. Doug, thank you very much for coming on. Why don't you tell people where they can find you at?
You can find me at brainstormbrewery.com, where I have a weekly column. It is titled Conjured Currency. There's been about 44 articles written on it so far. I am taking a break this week because Thursday is the day my articles come out, and that happens to be Christmas Day. So the first article you will see from me is January 1st, 2015, And if you want to submit any questions or comments or anything you want me to talk about in my next article, you can find me on Twitter at Rose of Thorns, which is R-O-S-E-0-F-T-H-O-R-N-S. And I feel the need to elaborate on this because it's not exactly a magic name or my personal name. It is a name that I originally had from the Yu-Gi-Oh! Wiki website when I first played Yu-Gi-Oh! Competitively.
Wow.
Because there's a Yu-Gi-Oh! Card called Wall of Thorns, and I originally had that as my name for several years, and I was Wall of Thorns in pretty much every Yu-Gi-Oh! Forum ever, and then that name was taken eventually on some sort of site, so I just changed it to Rose of Thorns.
Okay, I'm just going to ask before we go then, are all the terrible things we as Magic players hear about Yu-Gi-Oh! True?
For the most part, yeah.
For the most part,
I don't know that we were asking Ryan necessarily.
I wasn't, well, I mean, but that's okay.
I played Yu-Gi-Oh! Back in the day, so thanks.
And like, if you ask a Yu-Gi-Oh! Player, are most of the bad things you hear about Yu-Gi-Oh! True? In my experience, most of them will say yes too. They've just stuck with the game long enough that it's just sort of a Stockholm Syndrome thing.
I see. Like, the only exposure I've ever had to the game was, some people I knew in college, or a guy I knew in college was being, taught the game by someone else, and one day they just came back to school and were bragging about all their OTKs, which as I came to understand meant one turn kill.
Yep.
So, that just seemed real bad. And I heard lots of horror stories about the market and how cards crash hundreds of dollars overnight or something absurd, so.
Yu-Gi-Oh!
Just checking.
I stopped playing Yu-Gi-Oh! Several years ago, about 7 years ago, but I still have friends that play competitively, so I have sort of tangentially kept up with the small news about the Yu-Gi-Oh!, but it is true that $100 rare can be reprinted as a common overnight and just destroy the value of the card entirely forever.
That's brutal.
Yeah,
like,
people.
Of Duality was $100 secret rare, and it was reprinted as a common in the next set. I think.
I
believe that's true.
They shouldn't have did that, man.
Yeah, I think it was a base. I think it was a base rare in the next set. But either way, it was still like nothing.
I don't like that story being out there because, like, anytime we're like, Wizards can't violate their reprint policy, and they're like, oh, look at Yu-Gi-Oh, that's still going.
I think it's more a question of what would that do to consumer confidence because it would destroy it. Wizards has done a lot of work to build a trust between them and their player base.
Another difference between Yu-Gi-Oh! And Magic is the people buying Yu-Gi-Oh! Packs aren't the people playing Yu-Gi-Oh! The parents of people playing Yu-Gi-Oh!
Exactly.
Are the ones buying the Yu-Gi-Oh! Packs.
Because it's a bunch of kids, right?
Yeah.
Is that true? Yeah, okay.
For the most part.
Yeah, the average player is much lower. I mean, there are older people that play it, and there's like a lot of, like the people who are older and play it don't actually buy cards though. They just go to the shops and trade.
They just want to spike the little kids, I see.
Exactly. It's
sounds
I mean,
awesome.
Not everybody's out like that. Like there are fine people who play Yu-Gi-Oh! It's just that like the majority of people I meet are not those people.
I'm sure the Yu-Gi-Oh! Financial podcast is going to come after us for saying bad things about
the
game,
Yu-Gi-Oh!
But.
Finance podcast.
Yeah, dump every card you have that's worth more than $5. That's the Yu-Gi-Oh! Finance podcast. Cause it's
anyways, like I said, I've only ever heard these things about it. So I just wanted some confirmation, and it seems that we're receiving it, so.
Yeah.
It's risky.
Okay, back to the non-rant, you can also find me on Reddit, which the username would be identical there. You can add me on Facebook, my name is Douglas Johnson. The profile picture is the same as the one that was used in the New York Times article, and you can find me also on the New York Times in one small article from like over a year ago.
You know, cool people call it The Times.
Shut up.
You should get with the times, because they're changing.
Goddamn. Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
So
all right,
the real
Jason.
Talent now?
Whoa,
oh
whoa.
What happened?
What is this last second cameo by Marcel?
Hey, I had an opportunity. I could jump in, so I got to get squeezed
in. Oh, my gosh, Marcel. We're literally wrapping up.
Well,
we're
hey.
Out here for the last 60 seconds, bro.
I'm your
Merry Christmas to everyone.
Merry Christmas.
That's just it right there. The Marcel cameo ends it.
Happy
drop
Hanukkah, joyous Kwanzaa, whatever UFO-based holiday the Scientologists celebrate.
Festivus. We all like Festivus, right?
Festivus,
we should
yes.
do a Festivus airing of grievances right now, actually.
No.
Hey, hey, DJ, how you doing? It was good to
oh
see you
gosh.
In Jersey. Did you enjoy the cast?
What is this?
I was bummed out that I didn't get to be interviewed by you, so I had to settle for Corbin.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Now the shit talking starts. Excellent.
He got interviewed by the actual journalist. It was a
sorry,
blowout.
sorry you got downgraded. You know, I apologize.
Next time, Marcel.
Yeah, have fun. Have fun putting an ending to that after you crashed it.
Hey, this is the ending. This is how we roll, right?
Oh my god.
There's no professionalism in this podcast.
the Marcel. This was the this is the who is it? Nah, whatever. This is the Chuck Norris. Shut up. This is the Chuck Norris in Dodgeball cameo. Comes in at the last second just to make his presence known.
Oh god, Corbin's so salty. Smells like the Pacific Ocean over here.
We can be found on GatheringMagic.com and BrainstormBrewery.com.